Blog Talk Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, damas y caballeros,
welcome back to a live edition of Leaving the Ring Radio. It's been a while since I've been on live, right? I'm over eating peanuts and stuff because I was rushing to get home so we can do this here with the return back to myself and Mr. Gabriel Montoya. And I was running late, so I was kind of worried for a minute here because I was like, oh, shit, are we going to be able to do this live? But I'm here. So if you hear me chewing away, it's because I'm eating peanuts. At the same time, I'm drinking water with Pepsi. trying to, because, you know, I was running late because I was working. Anyways, so we have a lot to talk about here on Leaving the Ring. I know a lot of folks were asking us on Gmail, hey, are you guys going to do a live show? I wanted to do a roundtable, but everybody's time was different because there was a lot of folks that I wanted to have on that were going to be at the Triple G and Canelo fight in Las Vegas at the MGM and stuff. But I did have a chance, Gabriel, to talk to Randy Caballero, who's going to be facing the cousin of Oscar De La Hoya, Diego De La Hoya. And, you know, he was in really good spirits. First off, he seemed really excited. Like, he was happy. The fight was happening. And he did tell me that, hey, it's going to be a tough fight, but I'm confident I'm going to win the fight. But the one question that I had that I think most folks, you know, have had about Randy is about his hands. Because if anything, his hands have been an issue. It's been preventing him to be consistent in the ring. And he said, there's no worries there. They're really healthy. You know, his hands are healthy. He's ready to go. And that's what he keeps saying over and over. I'm ready to go. I'm ready to go.
So, yeah, I actually – we kept playing kind of gym tag when I was down staying there end of the year and in the beginning of the year when I was down there in the Coachella Valley for my mom. Checked out his gym and everything, but I just missed him. But I know Randy has not – it isn't – I don't think he gets fat between camps issue or a focus issue. It's been, yeah, this hand issue. And it seems like they've been over that hump for a while. I'd like to see – what he can bring to the table for Diego De La Hoya. What questions can he ask? Because it seemed like Randy had I wouldn't say they were all over the place, but things were just a little shaky. There was inactivity, and then they came back, and then we're trying to find the right fight, and here we are. It's a true crossroads fight. This fight, because I think Diego De La Hoya has improved every fight, but I still don't know if he's championship caliber level, or if they're just really bringing him along with that name. I haven't seen any fights that make me feel like he's Chavez Jr. I tend to think that, like I said, he's improving. Good jab. He's starting to learn how to move.
I don't even think that Adrian Broner is in the Chavez Jr. category. That's how bad Chavez
no
Jr.
question.
is.
There's no
right?
question. Segundo Carnera. Yeah, he's Primo Carnera 2.0 there. Chavez Jr. is a whole different kind of mirage. I think Diego is good, and this is it's kind of one of the hardest kind of fights, I think, for a promoter and for the fighter, for everybody involved, because you've got, Oscar De La Hoya is the promoter, Diego De La Hoya is the fighter. But Randy is one of their first champions and one of the first fighters with Golden Boy that they brought, from seed to fruit. And now he's in this kind of crossroads about who in the stable is going to move forward and who's going to have to go soul searching after this. Who do you lean towards in it? I'm a little close to it for me to make a pick,
Yeah, exactly. I mean, in terms of crossroad fights or even in terms of because you can't call them prospects anymore. But if you look at what they have done, and considering the fact that where they're at right now, in the 70s and the 80s, even the early 90s, they would still be called prospects. I'm thinking about Diaz Jr. versus Guy. What's his last name? Oh my God, I can't believe I just went blank right now. He's out of the Bay.
Guy Rob.
There's a strong possibility you can get something like that, where it's a fight of the year or potentially a great fight between the two. There's a because you have two guys that have a lot on the line. Here's the animosity that becomes between the two. Is that Caballero was claiming and saying that De La Hoya's camp didn't want this fight, whereas Oscar's older brother told Eric Gomez, when Eric Gomez had said on his Twitter feed, asked them why the fight wasn't happening, he had told them basically to be quiet about it, because I guess behind the scenes they were trying to negotiate a deal that could be feasible for both guys. So there's animosity between the two, because I remember when Caballero's camp called me and asked me to be on Leaving the Ring, and this is the time when the hiatus was happening between Leaving the Ring, whereas I wasn't really doing well. I'm not doing, but I just don't care to do a lot of interviews anymore, you know. But they asked me about it, and I was truthful to them. I was like, well, I'm not really doing interviews, you know, and let's just see where it goes from here. And there was enough between the two that sparked the demand between the guys to get in the ring. Whether or not there was roadblocks, obviously there was, because one camp, which is, like I said, Oscar De La Hoya's older brother, who manages the cousin of Diego De La Hoya, said, hey, you know, before you guys start opening up your trap, shut it, let's see what happens. And now we got this fight. So I'm expecting, and I hope to expect this, is a good fight between the two. Now, what you ask right now, who do I have? Well, if you have to lean with somebody, you got to lean with Diego De La Hoya. Why? He's been consistent. Randy Hands has been a problem. But skill-wise, I got to lean with Randy. I think Randy Caballero has, by far the more better technique in certain ways. But Red, you know, Red Garcia, who's been a good friend. I mean, I've known him for years, man, since we were kids. And he was part of Leaving the Ring. I started him off in here on Leaving the Ring. Now he's a publicist. He's been doing great with a lot of fighters, particularly with the Golden Boy fighters. He's done great work with them. He even told me today in the conversation, saying, Dave, this is a 50-50 fight. I think we have a 50-50 fight. And I think for the first time in being real about it, Gabriel, is we do have a 50-50 fight here between two fighters that are very hungry.
Yeah, I think the wild card is what does Diego De La Hoya have at the championship level? Because Randy's at least, picked up a belt, right? Or at least gotten to that.
Right.
To that, upper level. So he knows what it's like. He's had one fight in 2017. He got a decision. It was a solid comeback fight. So he's not super rusty. He fought in March. Here he is again in September. But he only fought once in 2016, and he hadn't fought in 2 years, in between that and 2014. So, I wouldn't say it's like, oh, he's fought a string of fights and he's all ready to go. But at least he's had one in this year. Randy comes in at 5'6", 68-inch reach. Diego De La Hoya comes in at 5'6", with a 68-inch reach. De La Hoya is 19-0, 9 KOs. Randy's 24-0 with 14 KOs. So you would think that, he is more of the puncher. Although, as of late, he's been going, more rounds. So, I think it's going to come down to tactics. And I feel like when I look at Randy, he is a little bit more fluid in the upper body. Diego De La Hoya has a good stick, good feet, fights a little bit tall, good guard. But I just think that Randy might be able to get into the body, get in a little closer. I think of him as a little more shifty in the fight. I could be wrong. I mean, I think the styles are going to mesh really well. I think it's going to be an action fight. I don't really have a pick. I tend to think that the money is leaning towards De La Hoya because of the name and the lineage
right.
and all that. But, experiences with Randy. So it's a solid fight.
You know, I think with De La Hoya, in terms of experience, he's the lesser guy. With Randy having a title and hearing that he is a person that holds a title, it's obviously going to up his confidence build, right? But the inactivity is the one thing you got to go in, you got to worry about. You know, I don't know if you noticed this, but I did notice this in a pitcher. And I asked Randy about this. I said, hey, there's a certain pitcher that was taken in terms of when you guys were facing off after the weigh-in. He looked a little bit bigger. Randy goes, I didn't notice that. At times, though, I do slouch my shoulders. And then when I decide to stand up taller, I am a bit taller than when it's recorded. So that's one thing that I saw. But we all know that size sometimes in boxing doesn't matter. And we'll get into a little bit about that when we talk about Canelo versus Triple G. But in terms of being more confident of being out there, having the limelight, having of the experience of facing guys in terms of, in the pro rankings, Randy Caballero is the guy that you have to look at. My pick, if I had to have a pick, and I'm being forced to have a pick, I'm going to go with Randy Caballero. I don't think there's no knockage. I don't think nobody gets knocked out. I don't think Randy carries the power that he did at the smaller weight divisions. And we've seen that he's moved up. He doesn't carry that, but when his hands are healthy, he does throw a good amount of combinations. But, Diego De La Hoya does the same thing. I potentially believe that there is a strong possibility they could steal the show. The problem is that people that are mostly tuning in for this fight are looking to see only Triple G versus Canelo, so they can potentially miss a very good scrap between these two gentlemen, Caballero and Diego De La Hoya. This past Saturday, the Superfly division.
They're not really known as big punchers. I think that's probably the big deal. Sorry, I was on mute.
Right.
And I was on a roll, but I was on mute. Here's one thing, though. You know, Randy picked up his vacant belt in Monte Carlo. So he's got the experience of traveling and fighting at a high level and succeeding. But it's actually Diego De La Hoya with this fight is fighting for his second time in the T-Mobile Arena. He fought Rocco Santamaro in 2016, May. In the T-Mobile Arena. So there is that. He's been in this environment before, but we'll see. I kind of shade towards De La Hoya in it, but it's a toss-up.
It definitely is a toss-up, and I wouldn't blame you for going with De La Hoya just because of the fact, like you said, the money is there for him. Caballero, to me, we're a golden boy. Frustration is, hey, we put money with you. You haven't lived up to the potential. It may be the argument is the hand issue. So this is to me the bet down on the table. Who's the guy that we go for next? Both of these guys have to potentially either have to shine or have to have a KO in order for everybody to go, okay, this is where we go. And there's a strong possibility, Gabriel, too. Both of the guys may give great efforts between each other where decisively you might have to end up saying, I want to see both these guys back again in the ring or back again on television because they made that much of a noise and that much of an argument that they're here to stay.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see. I can't wait to see the fight. I'm out of all of them. I mean, of the undercard fights, I think this might be the one I'm really looking at the most just because, because I know Randy but also I just think the styles are going to mesh and there's a lot on the line for both guys. I mean, this is career time for Randy and for Diego De La Hoya. You know, he could probably afford a loss a little more than Randy can, depending on how he loses. If it's a close decision loss. You know, Canelo doesn't have a close decision loss, but he has a decision loss and it hasn't really held him back. So we'll see.
No, I got to agree. I mean, you know, having a last name like De La Hoya, you can afford that loss. And having the backing of having Joel De La Hoya, you can have that loss. So, yeah, I totally agree. I mean, in terms of Superfly this past Saturday, these guys are the little guys that you need to watch out for because they can make exciting fights, you know. And I think this is going to make an exciting fight to help out the Triple G and Canelo, to, you know, for the lead up, you know, as the co-feature of the fight. This is a great, great, great matchup for that card.
Yeah, I there's just a question to me that this is actually a quality card. Like, it's like I was looking over, like, you know, the whole just top to bottom, and each fight to me is good. Each fight is like worth the money. This Joseph Diaz Jr. fight, like when you look at it, that could be another action fight. Have you broke that down at all?
I thought that it was called off. I saw people on Twitter saying that that fight was called off and all that. You know, maybe I got to double check. I thought that fight was no longer going to happen. There was an injury with his opponent. So I might be wrong, but I remember yesterday seeing that on Twitter that somebody was saying, a few people, folks were saying that that fight is no longer going to happen.
He has a new opponent. He's fighting Rafael Rivera now. His other opponent was injured, but no, he's still fighting. And this new opponent to me, seems, you know, not too bad. I think it's going to make for an action fight.
Well, Diaz, I can say it right now, Diaz always makes a great action fight, whether or not the guy is on the same level. But I think the kid's always proving that he goes out there and he looks to make the best of what is available in front of him. You know?
Yeah, no, he's fighting Rafael Rivera, who's 25-0, two draws, 16 knockout. He fights out of Tijuana, Mexico. He's age 23. He's a featherweight, right-hander. Last seen knocking out Ruben Tamayo in two rounds back in June of 2017. So, no, this is not just like I don't know what his condition was or how it was that he moved into the fight, but he's got the assignment. And as I'm looking here, Keith Idick is reporting on his boxing.
Which is a one-day assignment, though. Which is a one-day assignment. That's the only thing that I would be kind of concerned is that, okay, so how well is the conditioning? Was he training before getting called to face Diaz or not? I mean, is he one of those guys that stayed in the gym in between fights, you know?
He'd been training for a fight, according to this.
Okay.
Scene, for a fight against the Philippines, Drian Francisco, who had a terrible fight with Guillermo Rugendow, if you remember, on September 22nd in Ontario, California. So he moved up, his making weight a couple days, you know, but he's obviously been in the gym. I'm sure they gave him a weight that he could make. This could be a good fight, man. It could be a sleeper hit.
I'm hoping. Because we need that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, if anything, the major complaints about pay-per-view fights is that they're not very good. They're kind of boring, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But at the same time, you know what? The reason why, and this is just my opinion. The reason why you do see a lot of fights that are not that grabbing is because most people, and I think most people have showed this already, is that they normally show up only for the main event. A lot of folks don't pay attention to what's on the undercard. As of now, the attention span for most people is like 15, 20 seconds. So, you know, promoters are looking at, well, why am I going to spend extra amount of dollars to make a good card if only people are tuning in after the 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock bout? I might be wrong, but that's just my opinion about it.
Yeah, anyways, I don't know. I think they program TV different than they you know, the live in Vegas, it's always going to be that. It was always my experience that the people showed up late. But, you know, in Los Angeles, when the cards are good, look at Superfly, people were there. You know, people support. But I think this one, you know.
But that was a good card.
I want to see.
Right.
Yeah.
That was a good card. And that was a hardcore fight card. Let's be honest. Most of the people that showed up and most of the people that tuned in, most people that talked about it were hardcore boxing fans. And that's something that's just very it's almost like a myth now. You know what I mean? It's kind of like an urban legend. When you talk about a really good card and you talk about everything stacked, most folks don't even believe you. If you're a fan in the 80s and the 90s and you try to talk to that person that was that kind of a fan, they kind of look at you and go, yeah, okay, whatever, you know. Let's see what happens because of the disappointment value department, you know. There's that disappointment value that nobody wants to trust anymore. And that's what I've noticed. But I'll tell you what, this Saturday, the Superfly, I don't know about you. Were you disappointed? I wasn't disappointed. I actually got the money worth of what I witnessed and what I was finally going like, you know what, HBO, I'm not that pissed off this month that I paid.
No, it was everything that I wanted, you know. From top to bottom, each fight had depth, had swings in motion, swings of momentum rather. We got to see the monster come out and do his thing, knock somebody out, or at least, you know, stop somebody. And then we got to see the passing of the guard. I mean, Chuck Latito is a guy, which is really strange. I don't know if you found this strange. People really like shitting all over his legacy right after the fight, saying he was never pound for pound. Like Lou DiBella said that, which I still haven't talked to Lou about it. But man, I was surprised that here's a guy that had fought like a lot of quality opponents, heading up through multiple divisions, and
he wasn't
in the end of
pound.
His career,
right.
He didn't even move away from like tough matchups. He didn't sit there and say, "Well, I'm the king," or this and that, or you know, there was no bullshit. It was just all good fights. That's not pound for pound. Then we should get rid of pound for pound.
No, he's not. I think what most people what they really want to say was he wasn't pound for pound TV because he wasn't put in on HBO or Showtime or any other, you know, mainstream televised set for them to call him that. But before I even get into that, I got to tell you this: what I liked about the card was that the monster was put in the middle. They put Cuadros and Estrada to really kind of set the mood of what the fights were going to be on
HBO. I felt like that was like the main course followed by like
yes.
a really good dessert and then like some great drinks afterwards and maybe a little something else to nibble on.
You know what it was?
It
was a great appetizer, right? With a nice cold beer. And then they decided to say, hey, so we're going to give you a little extra. We're going to give you a good shot. And that's what the monster did with Nevis. They gave us a good shot, and then they go, okay, now we're gonna really intoxicate you, you know, with Gonzalez and Sora.
I think Gonzalez had the shot with everybody else, because man,
right?
He was
right?
looking a little listless out there.
Yeah, I mean, let's first talk about Estrada and Cuadros. I gotta tell you this, Cuadros out there, he went out there. His footwork was great. The beginning, the way he started the fight was great. There was no mystery to what he needed to do. He needed to box. He needed to move. He needed to do switch and hit, which he always does. His hand speed seemed very dominant. His confidence was obviously up there. But the conditioning, in my opinion, is what affected him to make the fight so close.
So I think he mismanaged his energy. Like, he needed to do everything that he was doing, but, like, half of that. Like, calm down, dude. Like, if you stop and hold still for a second, you'll notice that Estrada isn't really going that crazy. You know, he's getting in some shots. He's slowly cutting off the ring. But, like, too much nervous energy, too many times shifting. You know, like, what I liked about Danny Jacobs switching to southpaw or Terrence Crawford switching to southpaw they stay in it and they play it out. I'm going to look at everything from this angle. This guy's like shifting back and forth, and it's like, is it really throwing your opponent off that much, or, you know, what is it? You know, it was just way too much. And then by the middle of the fight, you're like, this guy isn't going to have much left down the stretch. And now he proved me wrong. He did have that jab, but you could just tell by the way each reacted to punches who was landing the harder professional shots and who was kind of scoring, you know, slap punching out for a while.
You know, patience was the virtue with Estrada, and for a moment you just sat there and you thought, man, Estrada's really slow. Maybe he doesn't know what to do with a guy that has fast feet and fast hands. Cuadros definitely is a guy that you can sit there And I thought the same thing. I was like, can he keep up this pace? But then when I remember him fighting Gonzalez, I was like, okay, he can keep up this pace. He could take a good shot. But visibly, Estrada's punches, like you said, they seem to be the more solid. They seem to be the more like in terms of you going like, oh, shit, that's a good shot. Where Cuadros was landing some, like, you know, I think in my turn, more number shots, but they were not the ones where you said, dude, he's going to break this other guy down. I was watching Estrada and I was like, every punch that landed hard, every punch that was precise, every punch that he was looking at and he was trying to be the sniper between the two seemed to be the bigger hit. So it wasn't small bullets. What I saw were big tank shots. Let me ask you, Gabriel, who do you think won the fight? Because I think that's what's the divide right now between fight fans and what I'm seeing on the Leaving the Ring Gmail, the divide between who thought who won the fight between those two.
You know, I didn't officially score it. I leaned towards Estrada. I felt like he won the fight, but then, you know, looking at my card, I did put down a card. But there was a couple swing rounds in there, like the ninth for me was a swing. You know, it just felt a little more like one dude had won the boxing match. I felt like Cuadros closed the 12th a little better. He still wasn't landing to me the hard punishing blows, but he was assertive with his jab and he was moving around. They were kind of fighting his fight. And Estrada, like, didn't put the cherry on top. But I don't, you know, I felt weird giving just, like, the first five rounds to Cuadros. I've only watched the fight once. And in those rounds, I felt like Estrada was landing great body shots and a hard hook here and there. And so, you know, it's all about perception. Is that guy moving around because the other guy's hitting him and hurting him? And so he's just trying to stay the hell away? And is that really ring generalship? Is that the guy that's in charge? And I think, you know, those first five rounds are probably really key.
You know what? Now that you're mentioning it, when I watched those first couple of rounds with Cuadros, I say the first, the second round, I was like, okay, this is the Cuadros that we saw versus Gonzalez. You know, he was peppering him. He had the better momentum. He was landing the cleaner shots. He was being mobile. It was very difficult to hit back. But little by little, Estrada was chipping away at the cinder block. And when he hit him, that cinder block, you could see pieces of the concrete just kind of, you know, chip off and fly. And that's what I saw with that fight. What I saw from fans' reaction, even on Facebook and on our social media, was a lot of them still felt that Cuadros' hand speed and movement was better. You know what the thing that we keep hearing a lot here in boxing, Gabe, is that you can't give rounds to guys that survive. When you think of Danny Jacobs when he fought Gennady Golovkin, that's one of the arguments that you hear from fight fans. You can't give him the round because he survived. Well, if that's the case, you can't give that to Cuadros versus Estrada, because going back with Triple G, I never really saw, except for the fourth where he kind of catches Danny Jacobs with a flash knockdown, but throughout the other rounds, I didn't really see Danny Jacobs get physically hurt or physically show me in my eyes while watching the fight that he was hurt. Where Cuadros, I did. I don't know if you did, but I did. I saw after the fifth, sixth, and seventh round, physically, he was being broken down by Estrada's punches.
Yeah, there's no question. I just felt like in the ninth, somewhere in there, Estrada could have hit it into another gear, and even the announcers talked about it. He's just not stepping on the gas to get it done. And so I think he left the question out there. He comes away with a victory, but I think that's where people see the the problem, I think, is a little bit down the stretch. Particularly for me, it was like the last round. I was like, that made it really close. But, you know, I it was a good, tough fight. I think they should do it again, but obviously he's got more more business to contend to, but, you know, beyond Quadras at this point.
Absolutely. Let's move on to the next fight. Let's talk about the next fight. Why don't you give the name of the next two guys that were on the Superfly?
Oh, wow. You're throwing that at me. That's rude, man. I actually didn't even have oh, that's what you meant by your text. So you had the guy with two names, you know, versus Chuck Latito, Soroksakat Sorungvisai, which gets more fun to say. Yeah, just Sorungvisai will do. But Nea Inui, I totally butcher that guy's name. It's very delicate. Versus Antonio Nieves was the second bout of the evening. Nieves, you know, he knew why he was there. And I just think he didn't want to... as things went on and he realized that Inui was like not going to take no for an answer, and just kept picking away at him with that hard 1-2. It was like an ice pick, just battering away at the guy's guard. You know, then it became like kind of cleanup duty, right, for the back end of the fight. A little
right.
depressing to watch, actually.
Well, you know,
but,
the monster,
like
Inui, right, I like him too. And I like that you know, he's game. I like the fact that he was trying to make a statement in the United States. And I think he did. I think he did for the Americans or anybody else that was tuning in to watch the fight. What I got to tell you, what I saw from Inui, is that I might be wrong about this, but if you put a guy like Carlos Quadros in front of him right now, my pick would be Quadros. Why? Because Quadros is going to show him, you know, different looks. It's going to cause problems. Quadros can take a punch, and you could see that. Estrada is a strong puncher. To me, Estrada is a more peppered, a more seasoned, experienced guy than the Monster Inui, than anybody else in the flyweight division at this moment. You know, even going with Sorungvisai, Quadros seems to be the more the guy that is willing to weather certain storms so he can land the more precise punches on his opponent.
Yeah, I don't know. It's hard to say, you know, who's the top guy there. I mean, I think a round robin needs to happen. I think Sorungvisai clearly is the man, you know, who ended the Chuck Latito reign. So I think more
right.
than anybody, he's the man at this point. You know, controversially the first time, or closely, I would say, rather than controversially. And then the second time just leaving no doubt, just cleaning the guy out. It's brutal to watch. You know, I felt really bad for him. But you look across the division, and like the Monster, you know, that guy's also looks like he's physically going to be a problem. A little stiff up top, and you know, really his bout was the showcase bout. We don't really learn a whole lot from him, and you know, he's the same height, 5'4.5". One Francisco Estrada's 5'4", you know, 67-inch reach, 66 for Estrada. He's not towering over everybody and like, oh my God, he's so big for the division. You know, it can't hold
right.
him. So, you know, we'll see. It's going to come down to skills, and this division. People that, you know, sizists, I guess you'd call them, people that don't like the smaller weight classes because they're tiny, I just don't really get it. I mean, you look at the top guys here in this division, and there's just nothing but action fights to be made.
Right. No, I agree. You know, and for the guys that are criticizing, you know, Gonzalez about being pound for pound, listen. Guys that dare to be great don't always accomplish the assignment that they set themselves to set. Okay. Here's the thing.
I'm sorry. You can't point at Floyd's record and go, he's 50-0 though. It's like, yes, he gave
yeah,
me a system
right.
and that he got to pick his right opponents and he made tons of money doing it. You guys helped him do that. I didn't buy his cards.
Exactly.
But it's not the same thing. You can't tell me Robert Guerrero was this force in the welterweight division that Floyd had to reckon with. You can't tell me that Andre Berto was that when Floyd fought him.
No.
This undefeated obsession is, I'd rather see what, you know, one of these guys is going to have a loss. You know, Diego De La Hoya, if he has a loss, it's going to be, well, you know, welcome to the De La Hoya family. Oscar had losses because he fought.
Yep.
You know, whether you agree with the decisions or not, he fought the toughest people in his division when they were their toughest. That's what it's about. Or at
exactly.
times he was at his weakest.
To me, that's what makes a pound-for-pound guy. To me, that's what makes
yeah.
the guy much – that separates the champions from the belt holder. Is the guy that's willing to move up in weight, the guy that's willing to take on the best oppositions that are out there, that it's available, whether or not it's in their division, and it's the impossible, okay? Now, you know, the reason why folks are going like, oh, he's not pound for pound, because maybe he lost to is not a recognizable name. He lost to a guy that most people didn't even think about, but the Thailand fighter, Rungnisai. Most people didn't know who that guy was. Most people were like, okay, who is this dude that gave him a tough fight? Who was Cuadros that gave this guy a tough fight because HBO was talking so highly about Gonzalez? But if you look at throughout his career, he fought the best of the best. Decided, hey, I'm going to jump up. It's not a weight division that I seem dominant, but I'm going to do it anyways because I dare to be great. To me, and I think for really hardcore boxing fans like yourself, Gabriel, to me, that is the most noble thing you can do as a fighter, which is challenge yourself. You may not win all the time, but I tell you what, 20 years from now, real fight fans are going to look back and appreciate that. Tito Trinidad didn't have to move up to middleweight. He could have stayed at 154. He looked very dominant at 154. He fought the number one and number two, number three spots in middleweight division at the tournament. Just got in with a guy that had his number by the name of Bernard Hopkins. To me, that does not diminish what Tino Trinidad was at the time. Same thing with Oscar De La Hoya. Didn't diminish who he was, Hall of Famers. Guys that challenged themselves. Guys that wanted to find out if they were better of who they were if they moved up. They knew they were dominant at a smaller weight division, but they said, hey, I'm going to try something, which is I'm an alligator in this swamp, and I want to go out to the ocean and challenge myself against a shark.
Yeah, and here's, you know, his wins gain, too. He beats Juan Francisco Estrada. You know, in 2012, and here the guy is, you know, sharing a card with him several years later, 5 years later, and you know, winning a close tough fight, get himself back into position in another division for a title shot. This isn't a guy that beat somebody within his own universe, managerially speaking, and just, you know, kind of silent agreements. We'll get these guys when they're done. I'll fight them. We'll do it on pay-per-view and call it something worthwhile. I mean, you know, it is what it is. I mean, I guess there's just different camps of people. It's a strange thing, though, is you and I both grown up about the same age, in our 40s, watching, you know, the United States kind of grow up in our lifetime in the era of Michael Jordan, one of the greatest pitchmen of all time. And that's really what people are interested in anymore, it seems like, is the well-marketed athlete, the well-marketed fighter. They talk about the bank account rather than the legacy. What did this guy do?
Right.
And maybe
right.
say, well, he didn't make that much money, so screw K2 and screw all the other people that had him. And, you know, that's what it's really about. And maybe they're right. You know, I don't know. I think it's somewhere in the middle. But anybody that denigrates Chocolatito for losing in four rounds to a guy that he put life and death with, and you look at the fights previous to that he'd had, dating back to that Estrada fight, the man put on a lot of miles by the age of 30, just under 50 fights. That's what the little guys do, and I don't know. I was shocked that you said that, to be honest.
You know what I'm shocked about is, like, okay, if you look at Bernard Hopkins, who's considered a legend, was considered one of the best in the world, okay? When he fought Joe Smith, you could see literally he was done. I mean, he took a beating, went out the ring, and still couldn't give the guy the props in terms of this guy beat me, Joe Smith. Where Gonzalez lost trading shots and still very much looked like he was in the fight. Yeah, did he look like he was losing the fight? Did he look like he got hurt on the second, third round? Absolutely. But he never gave up. He never gave up. So why don't we give this guy the medal of a purple heart of trying his ass off, of trying to stay in there and show that he's still one of the best in the world? Where Bernard Hopkins showed from the second, from the first to second, he was no longer Bernard Hopkins, the executioner, anymore.
You could see it. I mean, you know, it's the fighters sometimes last to know, you know, or maybe they know all along, and we're all the last to know. Like, they're like, oh, he, whatever he was thinking, whatever doubts he was having, he was right. He's done, you know. And you look at Chuck Latito in the opening moments of that bout, and my first thought was, boy, he's dry. I don't know if you noticed that, but he just didn't look like he had warmed into a lather yet. And Rungvisai, just, you know, as Chuck Latito would say after the fight, you know, they exchanged punches, and Sor Rungvisai just seemed a little bit harder. You know, he just hit me just a little bit harder. And
he looked
and
like a champion.
You could
Sor
see
Rungvisai,
it.
Yeah, Sor Rungvisai definitely looked like a champion. And I was glad that was the one thing that HBO commentators finally got right, is that when a guy wins a championship belt, sometimes it ups their confidence. It makes them believe that they are worthy of being called a champion. And he definitely fought like he was a champion. So the Estrada fight makes it that more interesting. You got a guy that's now beat one of the pound for pound best, one of the best in our generation. If you want to talk about generation, you know, Gonzalez is one of the best of our generation, whether or not you barely started watching him, whether or not you're going to question about him making the jump and weight. You cannot deny his skill set. You can't deny the fact that he was giving guys that were bigger than him, physically, visually. You could see these other guys, Cuadros and everybody else, was bigger than the kid, and he was giving them fits. So it just made that more of a sweeter, in my terms, make it more of a sweeter in terms of making matches with the other guys that were in the flyweight division. So Robin, like you said, the ring Robin.
Robin. Yeah. I've watched a lot of fighters. Just to say that he's not pound for pound, I've seen a lot of world-class fighters, like, up close, like live and in sparring, and he's as good as or better as anyone I've ever seen, Chuck Latito. I got to see him live in Pomona. I got to see him in Los Angeles. And for the Estrada fight, I was there. And the guy is just great balance, the combinations, ring IQ, the little subtle adjustments with the footwork. Ramon Gonzalez is as good as they come. True, I think pound for pound, it's what every fighter at the top of that should be. You should be able to check all the boxes: entertaining, gritty, he's got a chin, combination puncher, good balance, good footwork, good defense. Like, all those things should be above average. But he should be the total package. And to say, you know, because he ran into a guy that he couldn't beat, and he made two tries at him. Well, I mean, you know, Rosendo Alvarez gave Ricardo Lopez a lot of trouble, right? I mean, there's somebody for everybody in this sport. That's one of the beauties of boxing. And clearly, Sor Rungvisai is Ramon Gonzalez's.
Yep. Yeah. You know, it's always said in boxing, you know, somebody has their number. Oscar De La Hoya met Mosley. Antonio Margarito met Mosley. It happens. It happens in the sport. I'm definitely going to cover on the spotlight, the boxing spotlight. I'm going to cover a couple other things that we're not going to be able to talk here on the Leaving the Ring because we're cutting for time. So we're going to move on specifically because of the fight that we are all tuning in right now, which is the fight that most of us didn't believe was going to happen. Which is Gennady Golovkin versus Saul Canelo Alvarez. Everybody's excited about this. I'm excited about it. Montoya, I'm pretty sure you're excited about this because it's finally a fight that fans around the world were hoping was not going to be a prolonged situation the way Pacquiao and Floyd Mayweather was going to happen, right? But let me tell you this. because some of the things that have been sent on the Leaving Ring Gmail was comparisons to Tommy the Hitman Hearns versus Marvelous Marvin Hagler, which happened in the 80s, a middleweight fight that gave us three most phenomenal rounds that probably will never, ever be would ever have a competitive set of rounds with another set of fighters. But let me give you some comparisons here, okay? Canelo Alvarez is finally facing Triple G, who's never campaigned as a middleweight, okay? Now, he did it at a higher weight division with Julio Cesar Chavez Jr. I just spilled my soda, goddammit. waving my hands around here like I'm waving my hands like Donald Trump over here. And I just spilled my soda on my rug. My wife's going to kill me. Anyways, let me get my train. So Canelo Alvarez has never competed in the middleweight division. He did at 164, which was a catch weight with Julio Cesar Chavez Jr. Now, Julio Cesar Chavez did not give us the answers to our questions, which was how is Canelo going to react to a bigger guy, a big punch, and what is he going to do when the guy pushes him back and gets him against the ropes? We didn't get that answer. Here's the thing. Tommy the Hitman Hearns had never competed at the middleweight division either. He was 147 to 154. The fight finally happened, and it was his first fight at 160 pounds against Marvelous Marvin Hagler. Same thing with Canelo, what's happening this Saturday night. It's going to be his first fight. Here's another thing about the similarities to this fight. Marvelous Marvin Hagler was looking for the respect, not from hardcore fight fans, from outside household names and media. He was looking for the respect to be called the middleweight champion of the world. Gennady Golovkin is in that same position. We all know, as hardcore boxing fans, he's a legitimate middleweight. But he hasn't been crowned that yet by the casuals and the outside media that don't tune in to boxing. Okay, the similarities that are not there is that Thomas the Hitman Hearns was a big puncher. We saw that when he knocked out Roberto Duran at 154. Canelo's career has been throughout showing he knocks out guys that either have a weaker chin or much smaller men. So that's where the similarities are not there. The other thing is that Thomas the Hitman Hearns is an aggressive fighter who could box, but always opt to try to be the aggressive guy to look for the KO. Canelo's not, he's never been like that. He's a counter puncher. He's okay. He's comfortable going backwards. He's comfortable of trapping himself on the ring, and he's comfortable counter punching. Triple G has showed, like Marvelous Marvin Hagler, that he can move forward and he can be aggressive. The difference between Triple G and Marvelous Marvin Hagler, though, is Hagler has always, before going into the Hearns fight, before going into any other fight, he was known as a boxer southpaw. He wasn't really known as being this reckless, let me go balls all out. He only opted to do that because he felt, here's Tommy the Hearns, Hitman Hearns, taller guy, got a great right hand, can knock out or turn around a fight. I got to go to him. I got to find out how hard he hits, and then I can adjust to that. Triple G has been a little bit different than that. That's what all makes everything a bit interesting to me in this fight, Gabriel.
Huh. Yeah, I mean, I'd heard somebody else had compared it to, I think it was Hearns Duran or Leonard Duran a little bit, which I thought was kind of strange. I don't know, I've heard a few kind of classic. I just think it's two of the best marketed guys in recent history, you know, in the middle divisions. Triple G is like done it the hard way, you know, made some promotional mistakes early on. Then he got with K2 and you know, wasn't shelved within his own stable. He was kind of stuck behind, I think, Felix Sturm early on. gets his belt and kind of works his way slowly with Abel Sanchez to prominence. And they've done a great job. I mean, I wouldn't call him a pay-per-view fighter, like I brought up in the next round. I'm curious to see what the numbers do look like when he fights with, with these two guys that everybody wants to see, just after this August 26th fight between McGregor and Mayweather. I'm curious if there'll be a hangover, if the real fight fans, probably did what most people talked about, was like watch it on the, Steve calls it the radio, and save their shekels for this fight. Stylistically, I wonder.
Well, if you look at, I'm sorry, I'm just going to point to that because you said something right now about Sugar Ray Leonard. If you look at this, here's another similarity. Is that you have two guys that are in the shadow of supposedly the biggest star in boxing, which is Mayweather. Hagler and Hearns were in the shadow of Leonard. And Triple G and Canelo are in that shadow. And they could potentially break out of that shadow if they give us a great fight. The winner, if they give us a great fight and they give us the thirst that we're looking for between a potentially great match in boxing, it can actually break us out, in my opinion, break us out of this whole, BS of, oh, this is why I don't watch boxing. This is why boxing is boring. There's a strong possibility we could break out of that, burst out of that box.
Well, people talk about, this might look like, that Abel Sanchez said that the jab is going to be huge for Triple G in this fight. They both have excellent jabs. They both protect their face well when they're jabbing. And it's kind of this pole axe that they get going off the back foot, like exploding. But he said it's not going to look like the Lemieux fight. And I think from their perspective, it's not going to look like the Lemieux fight. Maybe from, Canelo, I think that's what kind of fight he wants to have. Real controlled with the jab, 1-2, turn, have Triple G following him around trying to make a fight happen. And I think, for Triple G to be successful, he's got to do what you're talking about, is have that kind of Hagler-like energy. I think he's the more natural middleweight. He's going to burn less energy. He was like 164.4 7 days out. He's, a more efficient machine than Canelo, who we've seen tire, and we haven't seen fight a true Mexican war. He fights at his pace, and even when he lost to Floyd, who fights at an even slower pace. So we haven't really seen him, I think, push.
Well, let's be fair. I don't think I've seen either one of the guys fight a real Mexican war. One guy is a Mexican. The other one's campaigning to be a Mexican. And the guy that's been campaigning to be a Mexican told us that he was going to give a street fight to a guy that's from Canada, David Lemieux. And we didn't get that. What we got was a very strategic jab that controlled the fight and never put himself in the position to find out whether or not he's willing to go dog out in a fight. So
I don't mind strategic, I don't mind gamesmanship in the press and, a little misdirection. I mean, I think that's part of fighting, And he at least got the stoppage in that fight. But it was, it was interesting watching people's reaction to that. All of a sudden, he discovered the jab. He's always had the jab. If you go back, though, I would say if he had a Mexican-esque fight, it's the Kasim Uma fight early on. And, Kasim is not a 160, but that's a chest-to-chest fight. It's a really punishing, brutal fight. And Triple G, answers the bell on that one. Kasim Uma, not so much down the stretch. So I think, he's proven his mettle, but he hasn't fought. I mean, nobody would have accused Kasim Uma of being a puncher at 154, much less at 160. So we got two guys. I mean, he's faced Curtis Stevens, David Lemieux, all legitimate punchers. And I think guys that can put your lights out or at least, break you down, and change a fight with one punch. Who's Canelo fought that you would categorize as that? And all three of those guys were at least, Stevens probably past his prime, but still dangerous. David Lemieux is probably in the midst of his prime. And Danny Jacobs certainly is in his prime. Canelo?
Canelo,
anybody
to me,
like
has
that?
had, Well, he you know, here's the difference. I think Triple G, in terms of career, the chosen opponents for him to face have been the availability to an extent. When it comes to Canelo, that all changed when he got with Golden Boy. The matchmaking was the most important thing to market him and to keep him available for the biggest fight that would come his way, which the first time was against Floyd Mayweather. But it was forgivable because he was young, he was too green, and it was so early in his career. Whereas this one here, this is a lot different. Now, I've said this in the past. I don't think Canelo avoided Triple G. What I think is Golden Boy was doing their job, which was build this fight to the proper date of which would make it more competitive for their fighter. Which leads me to believe, Gabriel, I think this is a great point, in my opinion, to bring up, is that the 168 fighter that they decided to face, which was Julio Cesar Chavez, and decided to go, what was it, 164.5, to me was the flirtation to see how well Canelo could move at a heavier weight. Heavier weight and how fast he would look. Would he be mobile? Would he be able to throw, at a large amount of combinations and not tire out? To me, it was a Golden Boy and Team Canelo to look at this and register, if we fought Triple G, would it affect him to put some mass? Because he definitely came in with mass against Julio Cesar Chavez Jr. And I think that's why the muscle is put there, because they knew it wasn't going to affect them. Because one of the big questions that I've gotten from Leaving the Ring Gmail is the muscle that's been added to Canelo, shouldn't that fatigue him? And at first I was like, yeah, I think so, because you never want to add muscle. But then when you flirt and adding fat to a guy and then decide to trim it down to muscle, sometimes that could work. Sometimes that's okay. Rather than trying to build on muscle in the beginning and then trying to cut that muscle mass down, which we've seen in the past with fighters, Roy Jones Jr. is one to believe, is he built muscle mass in the heavyweight division to move up to heavyweight division. It's when he cut the weight, when he cut the muscle mass to try to make to a division he once reigned, it affected him. This is a little bit different. He didn't build muscle mass. What he did was just allow himself to be Canelo. Then they put the muscle mass on him at 160. I think it was a smart way of doing it. Why? Because he can endurance what's going to be coming at him. He also can still be the counterpuncher with speed in his hands, Canelo Alvarez. What do you think?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure. I don't know what his plan was. You know, I was watching the 24/7s, and it just, you know, seeing Triple G, I don't know how much of this is actually their training, you know? Is this his only track that he runs on the streets of Big Bear, you know, which is like lightly, you know, it's like pavement. And you know, not the best road. Didn't look like it's very pothole ridden, but it's like mountain road, you know? I get the sense that one guy's kind of more old school, and you know, I guess Canelo seems to be that way too. I mean, starting in the gym that he did, I think, you know, at 27, he's probably finally coming into his physical own, and the weight, people are like flipping out, and it's like everything's relative. Like the last time you saw him, he's 164, and he was facing a guy much bigger. And when you see him, like he's shorter than Triple G, but he seems kind of thicker. He's all neck and shoulders. He's got a gigantic head. But that's just a kid coming into his own, I guess. I don't know. I don't.
I mean, the kid looks like he's one of the horses that he rides. You know what I mean?
Yeah, seriously.
The kid looks like he's one of the horses that he rides. He's just a thick kid. I mean, he was looking like that at 140 pounds. This is nothing new. He's always looked bigger than his opponent.
Yeah, as a welterweight, he was a big kid. So, you know, it's – I was actually – X's and O-ing it. You know, who's got the bigger jab? Who's got the tighter defense? Will Triple G be able to get to his body? Because Canelo's got a nice guard. He really knows how to use it. He knows how to assert himself in there. But he does get hit. And when Triple G hits him with a right hand or catches him with a left, like, how's he going to react? Like, this would be the first legit puncher that's, you know, near his prime that he's faced at 160 or anywhere. How's he going to react?
You know,
anywhere.
The one thing.
Who else has
right.
he faced? I mean, James Kirkland, all of those could be just torn apart. He couldn't stop Miguel Cotto. Didn't even look like he was interested in stopping Miguel Cotto. You know, Chavez Jr., the same thing. Couldn't put that guy away. Couldn't figure out a way to put him away. Didn't seem to have the mean streak to put him away. How's
it's not his temperament. Yeah.
No,
it's not his
jam.
Temperament. You know, if you watch the guy's career, it's like I said, it's the matchmaking that made him look, that's given him the KO reels that we've watched, you know. If there's one thing that, like I was mentioning, you know, Hearns versus Hagler. Hagler said, I needed to take it to Hearns. I needed to find out how strong this guy is. Because finding out the depth of where this guy's at is going to allow me to adjust to the fight. Meaning that either I can be wild or I need to box. That's my opinion of what Triple G needs to do. Being that he has older legs, being that he has more wear and tear because he's been in boxing a lot longer, to me, he needs to find out, is Canelo power enough to keep him honest, or is it enough for him that he needs to use his jab and box the way he did against David Lemieux? Because
For him to be successful, I think he needs to back Canelo up and beat him to the punch. You know, he's got to win the battle of the jabs. His jab has to matter more, and he's got to get to the body. You know, I mean, he's just got to do all, it's the classic. We got to score more points to the other team. But I think Triple G has to be the assertive one. I think Canelo is going to come and try to take center ring and be authoritative with the jab. And I think Triple G can't let it be that kind of fight. If he's trying to
let me ask you
Canelo,
this.
He's doomed.
Let me ask you this, because I've been a critic to Gennady Golovkin's performance against David Lemieux, and one of it's because of the fact that he said he was going to make it a street fight against a big puncher, and I paid for the pay-per-view. I think that's why I'm kind of sour about it, because I paid for the fucking pay-per-view to watch it. I wanted to watch a war. But going back and watching this and looking at it, Triple G has showed me that he can box and box at a very controlled pace, meaning that he's not going to make unnecessary mistakes. With Canelo, have you seen that? I haven't seen him do that. Even when he fought smaller guys like Amir Khan, Matthew Hatton, Canelo is what you get, is a counterpuncher. You could actually lead the dance, and he can finish it if you're a smaller guy. But like with Miguel Cotto, he led the dance.
With the Mosley fight, actually, I mean, he boxed and moved a bit. That's a bit of a hidden gem. Rich Murata brought that fight up, and I went back and watched it. Canelo did box and move in that fight. And granted, it's Mosley, but you go back and watch him at 18.
But that's a one. That's a one-fisted puncher, though. I mean, with David Lemieux, you had a guy with two punches that throw both either hand. He had power. Young, still came forward.
I'm just saying, in terms of Canelo's ability to just box his way to a decision. I mean, I think he's got a good enough jab, and they match up well enough. We're gonna see though. Like Steve pointed out, I hadn't noticed it until you mentioned it on the show, and I pulled up the picture. When they face off, Gennady's pretty tall. I wonder, what the reaches are gonna be like, and is he gonna be able to dictate and come downhill on Canelo? That'll be interesting to see. I personally think it's a combustible fight that doesn't go the distance. I've got Triple G in 8 in a fight that maybe takes 2 rounds to heat up, and then a fight breaks out, and it gets real nasty until Canelo can't take anymore. Uppercuts and to his knees.
Canelo's neck tells me that he can last a lot longer than what most are suggesting. Canelo's counterpunching tells me that even if he backs up the rope, he's going to give Triple G some problems. I like Canelo's counterpunching. I like the fact that Canelo is very comfortable when he backs himself up, because it's not like it's not like he's being forced. It's premeditated. He walks himself back.
Yeah.
He sucks you in, and then he counterpunches. The other thing I love about Canelo.
Too.
Yes.
He parries
very well with his hands. The one thing too that stands out that Danny Jacobs showed me against Triple G is the body does make Triple G hesitate. Now, granted that Danny Jacobs is a tall, big middleweight, bigger than Triple G. Canelo is short, meaning that his body shots may get there a lot quicker and not be seen by Triple G if thrown.
Hmm.
Why? Because he's looking for the over-the-top shots.
Hmm. Well, yeah.
And I like that.
Canelo is a good. Yeah. I mean, you know, if you got to X's and O's it up, I mean, the older guy, like, do you throw everything out of Jacobs, or do you say, well, you know, throw everything out but the miles that were put on Triple G in it? I don't care what anybody says. It was a close fight. Danny got to his body. Danny hurt him late, in my opinion, the last moments of the fight. He certainly stuck it to him and won an exchange that people talk about. But, like, you know, is there anything else that Canelo can take from that fight? Do you think he's going to turn southpaw? And would it matter?
No. I don't think you can. I mean, he's never showed that he can be. I've never seen him. I can't even think right now. Has he ever turned southpaw? If one thing that Canelo's got to do, I think, is just beat Canelo. Like I said, the counterpuncher, allow Triple G to be the aggressor. I think he could tee off of that. I think going to the body and saying that he's a shorter guy is that he's going to be less visible to counterpunch when going to that body and keep his hands up high. I think the muscle that he's building around his shoulders and his arms are going to help him absorb some of the power punching from Triple G may help him. And I think that was the whole reason of building muscle mass. You know, if I'm a trainer and I'm looking at, okay, we need certain advantages. We need certain things that are going to help you in that ring. Building that certain mass is one of them. You know, try to build him an armor that it's going to be harder for him for Triple G to put a dent on. But, you know, I've spoken to so many different people about this fight, of who they're picking. And I got to tell you this, the majority of, I would say nine out of 10 Mexican Americans and Mexican Mexicanos have said the same thing to me. My heart is with Canelo because I'm a Mexican. But my brain is telling me Triple G. And like I said, the similarities to Hagler and Hearns is a guy, Hearns, coming into the middleweight division for the very first time facing the best middleweight champion. And Canelo is in that same light at this moment. The only thing that Canelo doesn't carry that Hearns had the strong possibility of winning the fight was a big right-hand punch. Canelo doesn't have that. I'm sorry. I know the HBO reels are showing you that he's got this big punch, but guys, if you're not a boxing fan and you don't know this, you have no reason to be picking who's going to be the winner of this, because you're going bases off of a mirage that he's a big puncher. Roy Jones could fool you all he wants, but Roy knows, hearts of hearts, Canelo is not a puncher at 160 pounds. Triple G is.
Well, we don't know.
Triple G is.
We just don't know. Yeah.
We don't. I mean, we do know. I think we do know.
I
mean, every guy,
you know, in the middleweight division and against Miguel Cotto, and then went to decision. So we know.
Well,
yeah,
when
he fought a giant puncher.
When he fought Chavez Jr., I said this on. Right, and I've asked this on Leaving the Ring. I said, okay, you think let's just put the let's put the scenario of Danny Jacobs or Triple G was in there with Julio Cesar Chavez, right? Do you think it would have went the distance of where it went? And do you think that if it was that one-sided, the referee would have jumped in knowing that Julio was in danger? I think those both scenarios would have happened. It didn't happen with Canelo because the ref never felt that Julio Cesar Chavez was in danger. Those punches were not evident of showing major damage to Julio Cesar Chavez. That's why I think they had 160-pound puncher.
You look at the guys he stopped in the last few years. You know, I mean, this is going back. Let's go back to 2012. So he beats Mosley in 2012. We'll just go look at his knockouts. Alfonso Gomez, Ryan Rhodes just before that. Matthew Hatton goes the distance. Yeah, Baldemir. We'll start from Baldemir. 2010, Carlos Baldemir, KO6. It was a highlight reel stoppage. Then he beats up Ryan Rhodes, a British journeyman in Mexico, stops him in the 12th round. Then 2011, beats Alfonso Gomez in six rounds. Then he comes right back with Kermit Cintron, stops him in five rounds. And these are not guys in their primes, like nowhere near it, and not even their best weight classes taking on Canelo. I think Alfonso Gomez was a welterweight at best, and Kermit Cintron was more of a welterweight than a 54. And there he is fighting Canelo. Shane Mosley goes to the decision. Then his next stoppage is against Josecito Lopez at 153, when everybody knew the deal. I remember hanging out with Josecito after that fight and just how dejected he was. But it's like, dude, you know, you went up against a mountain. You're more of a 140 who transitioned into a welterweight, and then you kind of cashed out against Canelo in 2012 at 153. Goes to distance with Austin Trout, goes to distance with Floyd Mayweather and loses. And then in 2014, stops Angulo in 10 rounds.
Right.
And then gets a split decision against Lara. 2015, James Kirkland stops in three, and Kirkland had been out of the ring for 16 months or something like that. Not with Ann Wolf for the first second time, but not with Ann Wolf. Never wins without her, actually. He's undefeated with Ann Wolf. Doesn't stop Cotto at 153.5. Knocks out Amir Khan in 2016, six rounds at 155. Khan's a career, really more of a 140, 147. And then he stops Liam Smith, a career 154-pounder, at 154 pounds, which is, probably the most prime dude that's natural to the weight class that Canelo has ever stopped is Liam Smith. Then he goes the distance with Julio Cesar Chavez Jr., who'd been stopped before, at 164. And so now
– which was – he was stopped by a much bigger man, Farah. Right.
This is a – he was a bigger man, but he's also lost to a smaller man in Sergio Martinez, so we'll call it a push.
Right.
But this is supposed to be the fight of the decade. And this is the guy. This is one half of the fight of the decade.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what I'm saying. We made the comparisons, and here's the not-so comparisons is, like I said, Hearns kind of proved he had a chance. Canelo, I don't know. I mean, but if you want to throw in Cal Brook and Danny Jacobs and how Triple G looks older, looks to receive more punishment than he has in his earlier bouts, you can make that case. And timing is always right. I like the timing of Canelo facing Triple G, even though, like I said before, the answers, in my opinion – and I've said this on Twitter just last week — we still don't know how Canelo's going to react to a middleweight. We are clueless to this, very clueless. What we have right now is a legitimate middleweight versus a legitimate household name. That's what we have. I believe your pick, Gabriel, was what? How many rounds that you're giving Canelo in this fight?
I would say, he's in great shape. I've always felt Triple G and 8, but, somewhere between 8 and 10. But, just one last rebuttal is that, like you said, timing's everything. And while we're looking at the knockout of Canelo Alvarez, you know, you go back and you look at the long knockout streak of Triple G, which is just something to behold, you know, just maybe not all the best names in the world, but just to operate at that level and be stopping guys. But, you know, they're older guys, Marco Antonio Rubio, Asumanu Adama was, you know, just kind of an also-ran contender. Curtis Stevens, journeyman guy. But, you know, dangerous nonetheless, stops some people, but hadn't really been an A-plus guy. Gabe Rosado, Gregor's Proxa, who, you know, I thought was pretty solid, and Golovkin, you know, just went right through him. I didn't pick him to win. Kasim Uma going, you know, stopping him in 10 rounds. That's probably his first notable stop, you know. I guess besides winning the title against Milton Nunez in like a minute, but you know, you look at Triple G, and you know it kind of goes up. You know, Willie Monroe Jr. He stops him in 2015. Then he stops David Lemieux in 8 rounds. I mean, you know, Lemieux had been stopped before, but had rebuilt, you know, and won a title. So it was a quality win, and he continues to win now. But then you got Dominic Wade, who's just a guy. You know, hadn't really done anything. Stopped him in 2 rounds. So I guess it shows, you know, if you're not even near the quality of Triple G, he'll stop you in 2. Kell Brook, a middleweight or a welterweight going up to 159.5. Triple G stops him in 5 rounds. And then we get Jano Jacobs, who shows us, I guess, you know, both of their classes, and then go the distance in a contested decision. And now we got Triple G versus Alvarez. I think, you know, he's put on some miles, and Triple G's taken a lot of punches. And he could be an older guy coming into this fight. He certainly got more war mileage on him. You know, when you look at those fights, those weren't easy knockouts. A lot of them were action fights. The Lemieux fight was an action fight. You know, he did, you know, use the jab a lot, but he was pressing the action. You still have to block stuff, take stuff on the arms, and move in and risk. You know, the Rubio fight was kind of a bowl over. He had to work for it with Martin Murray. I think it's a quality stop in, you know, 11 rounds. I just think Triple G, I guess the summation is that he brings the quality. That long amateur background, I know Canelo's had a hard road and as a young pro to this point, and maybe that's all prepared him. Maybe all these guys that aren't punchers but are experienced fighters have prepared him for Triple G. We're going to find out. You know, is this, are these guys marketing or, you know, are they the steak and potatoes that we think they are? I tend to think it's that. So I got Triple G and 8 to 10, but it's not going to be easy.
You know, the guys, like you just mentioned right now, you know, Canelo Alvarez went through the hard road. He didn't go to the amateur pedigree. He didn't have an Olympian backing, none of that, okay, as Gennady Golovkin. But the guys that have overcame that had one thing in common. Haseem Rahman didn't have the pedigree of amateur. Tito Trinidad didn't have the pedigree of having an amateur background. But what they did have similar was knockout power. Canelo doesn't have that. Triple G, like I said, the similarities with Hagler and Hearns, Hagler said, leading up to the fight and after the fight, I needed to go and take the fight to him to find out how big of a puncher he was so I can adjust to it. Triple G has to do that. The one thing about Hearns, though, that Canelo has over Hearns was Canelo, to me, is a great counter puncher. Understands how to counter punch. The one thing that Canelo's got to do in this fight, from my opinion, to win this fight, is commit and overly commit to the body. Keep the hands high, establish your jab, and just go solely to the body. Try to break down the momentum of whatever Triple G is going to bring to you. Because you already know, in my opinion, how the interviews and even seeing how excited Triple G is, he's probably going to bring the fight. He said he wasn't up for the fight with Danny Jacobs. So does that mean he's going to come out gun blazing with Canelo Alvarez because he's excited and he's been wanting this fight and he knows this is the big marquee fight of making him a household name? Those little things right there, if I have a fighter and we're looking at certain things to take advantage, you listen to those certain things and you know that this guy's willing to make a mistake. And you got to look for that and you got to capitalize against that. And that's something that Canelo's got to look for. And if I, whatever I'm hearing from the Triple G from his mouth, not from his camp, but from his mouth, meaning that he may make mistakes to land a big punch. Take advantage of it. What's my pick, though? Triple G on the 10th round. I think he stops him. I think Canelo's going to give this best performance against Triple G. He's going to be very valiant. He's going to try his best to show that he's a true Mexican warrior. But I think timing is everything. And I think that he may hurt Triple G. I think he has maybe the early rounds. But the chip away of what Gennady Golovkin brings in power is going to make the huge difference. So my pick is Gennady Golovkin, the 10th round. But please don't be surprised if Canelo can withstand any of that and go 12 rounds because of his neck and his side and his shoulders. I know they said you can't train a jaw to take a punch, but if his jaw's not there to be hit and Canelo's pretty good in using the shoulder to be a deflector, you got to give him the chance of lasting those 12 rounds. But I'm expecting that Gennady Golovkin is going to, he's going to paint the canvas, which is go to the body and back to the head, head to the body. And that's what's going to break him down. I'm expecting a good fight between these two. And I've never been a Canelo fan, but I think I'm going to probably respect him a lot more and his office performance this Saturday, Gabriel.
We'll see. I hope, you know, I think, you know, in some ways it's better if he has a great performance and pulls it out and knocks Triple G out. I think the sport would be healthier for the younger guy to win. Mexican fan base is gigantic. It would go through the roof if he could redeem himself this way. You know, losing to being outboxed by Floyd Mayweather at 152 won't be such a big deal if he could stop getting to Golovkin at 160. And he'll be the lineal champion. He'll be at all of it if he can do it.
Oh, yeah, most definitely. I mean, he will be up there with some of the great Mexicans, and I don't think you will question it. I mean, you can question his his earlier fights, but this one here will probably override anything that he's accomplished at this moment. Anyways, folks, I want to thank everybody that tuned in to Leaving the Ring here. As always, it's my pleasure. I'm glad to have Mr. Gabriel Montoya here back with me co-hosting on Leaving the Ring. We're going to be weekly here on Leaving the Ring. I'm not sure we're set on Wednesday. We still have to discuss this. There's still a little bit of things that me and Gabriel have to discuss on time and on day. But just to let you know, we're going to be back. And the OGs are back at doing the Leaving the Ring podcast. The reason why a lot of you guys out there are doing podcasts is because of Leaving the Ring. Anyways, don't spill your drink over the weekend. Don't drink and drive. See, that's how long it's been since I've been live on the air, Gabriel. I'm messing up my tagline here. Don't drink and drive because you will spill your drink. Again, Mr. Montoya, I'll talk to you soon.
Peace.